The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 12. At the Villa Marguerite.
"Then you were really in the thick of it all," said Lady Tamplin enviously.
"My dear, how thrilling!"
She opened her china blue eyes very wide and gave a little sigh.
"A real murder," said Mr. Evans gloatingly.
"Of course Chubby had no idea of anything of the kind," went on Lady Tamplin. "He simply could not imagine why the police wanted you. My dear, what an opportunity. I think, you know, yes, I certainly think something might be made out of this."
A calculating look rather marred the ingenuousness of the blue eyes.
Catherine felt slightly uncomfortable. They were just finishing lunch, and she looked in turn at the three people sitting round the table. Lady Tamplin, full of practical schemes, Mr. Evans, beaming with naive appreciation, and Lennox, with a queer, crooked smile on her dark face.
"Marvelous luck," murmured Chubby. "I wish I could have gone along with you and seen all the exhibits." His tone was wistful and childlike. Catherine said nothing. The police had laid no injunctions of secrecy upon her, and it was clearly impossible to suppress the bare facts or try to keep them from her hostess, but she did rather wish it had been possible to do so.
"Yes," said Lady Tamplin, coming suddenly out of her reverie, "I do think something might be done. A little account, you know, cleverly written up, an eyewitness, a feminine touch. How I chatted with the dead woman, little thinking... that sort of thing, you know."
"Rot," said Lennox.
"You have no idea," said Lady Tamplin in a soft, wistful voice, "what newspapers will pay for a little tidbit. Written, of course, by someone of really unimpeachable social position. You wouldn't like to do it yourself, I dare say, Catherine dear, but just give me the bare bones of it, and I will manage the whole thing for you. Mr. de Havilland is a special friend of mine. We have a little understanding together. A most delightful man, not at all reporterish. He does the... How does the idea strike you, Catherine?"
"I would much prefer to do nothing of the kind," said Catherine bluntly.
Lady Tamplin was rather disconcerted at this uncompromising refusal. She sighed and turned to the elucidation of further details.
"A very striking-looking woman," you said. "I wonder now who she could have been. You didn't hear the name."
"It was mentioned," Catherine admitted, "but I can't remember it. You see, I was rather upset."
"I should think so," said Mr. Evans. "It must have been a beastly shock."
It's to be doubted whether, even if Catherine had remembered the name, she would have admitted the fact. Lady Tamplin's remorseless cross-examination was making her restive. Lennox, who was observant in her own way, noticed this and offered to take Catherine upstairs to see her room. She left her there, remarking kindly before she went, "You mustn't mind, Mother. She would make a few pennies profit out of her dying grandmother if she could." Lennox went down again to find her mother and stepfather discussing the newcomer.
"Presentable," said Lady Tamplin. "Quite presentable. Her clothes are all right. That gray thing is the same model that Gladys Cooper wore in Palm Trees in Egypt.
Have you noticed her eyes?"
"What?" interposed Mr. Evans.
"Never mind her eyes, Chubby," said Lady Tamplin tartly. "We're discussing things that really matter."
"Oh, quite," said Mr. Evans, and retired into his shell.
"She doesn't seem to me very malleable," said Lady Tamplin, rather hesitating to choose the right word.
"She has all the instincts of a lady, as they say in books," said Lennox, with a grin.
"Narrow-minded," murmured Lady Tamplin.
"Inevitable under the circumstances, I suppose."
"I expect you will do your best to broaden her," said Lennox, with a grin. "But you'll have your work cut out. Just now, you notice, she stuck down her forefeet and laid back her ears and refused to budge."
"Anyway," said Lady Tamplin, hopefully, "she doesn't look to me all that mean. Some people, when they come into money, seem to attach undue importance to it."
"Oh, you'll easily touch her for what you want," said Lennox. "And after all, that's all that matters, isn't it? That's what she's here for."
"She's my own cousin," said Lady Tamplin with dignity. "Cousin, eh?" said Mr. Evans, waking up again. "I suppose I call her Catherine, don't I?"
"It's of no importance at all what you call her, Chubby," said Lady Tamplin.
"Good," said Mr. Evans.
"Then I will. Do you suppose she plays tennis?"
he added hopefully.
"Of course not," said Lady Tamplin. "She's been a companion, I tell you. Companions don't play tennis. Or golf. They might possibly play golf croquet, but I've always understood that they wind wool and wash dogs most of the day."
"Oh, God," said Mr. Evans. "Do they really?"
Lennox drifted upstairs again to Catherine's room.
"Can I help you?" she asks rather perfunctorily.
On Catherine's disclaimer, Lennox sat on the edge of the bed and stared thoughtfully at her guest.
"Why did you come?" she said at last.
"To us, I mean. We're not your sort."
"Oh, I'm anxious to get into society."
"Don't be an ass," said Lennox promptly, detecting the flicker of a smile. "You know what I mean well enough. You're not a bit what I thought you'd be. I say, you have got some decent clothes," she sighed. "Clothes are no good to me. I was born awkward. It's a pity, because I love them."
"I love them too," said Catherine. "But it's not been much use my loving them up to now. Do you think this is nice?"
She and Lennox discussed several models with artistic fervor.
"I like you," said Lennox suddenly.
"I came up to warn you not to be taken in by Mother, but I think now that there's no need to do that. You're frightfully sincere and upright and all those queer things, but you're not a fool. Oh, hell, what is it now?"
Lady Tamplin's voice was calling plaintively from the hall.
"Lennox, Derek has just rung up. He wants to come to dinner tonight. Will it be all right? I mean, we haven't got anything awkward like quails, have we?"
Lennox reassured her and came back into Catherine's room. Her face looked brighter and less sullen.
"I'm glad old Derek is coming," she said. "You'll like him."
"Who's Derek?"
"He's Lord Leckenbury's son. Married a rich American woman. Women are simply potty about him."
"Why?"
"Oh, the usual reason. Very good looking and a regular bad lot. Everyone goes off their head about him."
"Do you?"
"Sometimes I do," said Lennox. "And sometimes I think I'd like to marry a nice curate and live in the country and grow things in frames."
She paused a minute
and then added, "An Irish curate would be best, and then I should hunt."
After a minute or two, she reverted to her former theme.
"There's something queer about Derek. All that family are a bit potty. Mad gamblers, you know. In the old days, they used to gamble away their wives and their estates and did most reckless things just for the love of it. Derek would have made a perfect highwayman, debonair and gay, just the right manner." She moved to the door. "Well, come down when you feel like it."
Left alone, Catherine gave herself up to thought. Just at present, she felt thoroughly ill at ease and jarred by her surroundings. The shock of the discovery in the train and the reception of the news by her new friends jarred upon her susceptibilities. She thought long and earnestly about the murdered woman. She'd been sorry for Ruth, but she could not honestly say that she'd liked her. She had divined only too well the ruthless egoism that was the keynote of her personality, and it repelled her. She'd been amused and a trifle hurt by the other's cool dismissal of her when she'd served her turn. Then she'd come to some decision. Catherine was quite certain, but she wondered now what that decision had been. Whatever it was, death had stepped in and made all decisions meaningless. Strange that it should have been so, and that a brutal crime should have been the ending of that fateful journey. But suddenly Catherine remembered a small fact that she ought perhaps to have told the police, a fact that had for the moment escaped her memory. Was it of any real importance? She had certainly thought that she'd seen a man going into that particular compartment, but she realized that she might easily have been mistaken. It might have been the compartment next door, and certainly the man in question could be no train robber. She recalled him very clearly, as she'd seen him on those two previous occasions, once at the Savoy and once at Cook's office. No, doubtless she'd been mistaken. He'd not gone into the dead woman's compartment, and it was perhaps as well that she'd said nothing to the police. She might have done incalculable harm by doing so. She went down to join the others on the terrace outside. Through the branches of mimosa, she looked out over the blue of the Mediterranean, and while listening with half an ear to Lady Tamplin's chatter, she was glad that she'd come. This was better than St. Mary Mead. That evening, she put on the mauvey pink dress that went by the name of Soupir d'Automne, and after smiling at a reflection in the mirror, went downstairs with, for the first time in her life, a faint feeling of shyness. Most of Lady Tamplin's guests had arrived, and since noise was the essential of Lady Tamplin's parties, the din was already terrific. Chubby rushed up to Catherine, pressed a cocktail upon her, and took her under his wing. "Oh, here you are, Derek," cried Lady Tamplin, as the door opened to admit the last comer. "Now, at last we can have something to eat. I'm starving." Catherine looked across the room. She was startled. So this was Derek. And she realized that she was not surprised. She'd always known that she would someday meet the man whom she'd seen three times by such a curious chain of coincidences. She thought, too, that he recognized her. He paused abruptly in what he was saying to Lady Tamplin and went on again as though with an effort. They all went in to dinner, and Catherine found that he was placed beside her. He turned to her at once with a vivid smile. "I knew I was going to meet you soon," he remarked, "but I never dreamt that it would be here. It had to be, you know, once at the Savoy and once at Cook's, never twice without three times. Don't say you can't remember me or never notice me. I insist upon your pretending that you noticed me anyway." "Oh, I did," said Catherine, "but this is not the third time. It is the fourth time. I saw you on the blue train." "On the blue train?" Something undefinable came over his manner. She could not have said just what it was. It was as though he had received a check, a setback. Then he said carelessly, "What was the rumpus this morning? Somebody had died, hadn't they?" "Yes," said Catherine slowly. "Somebody had died." "You shouldn't die on a train," remarked Derek flippantly. "I believe it causes all sorts of legal and international complications, and it gives the train an excuse for being even later than usual." "Mr. Kettering," a stout American lady who was sitting opposite, leaned forward and spoke to him with the deliberate intonation of her race. "Mr. Kettering, I do believe you've forgotten me, and I thought you such a perfectly lovely man." Derek leaned forward, answering her, and Catherine sat almost dazed. Kettering! That was the name, of course. She remembered it now. But what a strange, ironical situation. Here was this man whom she'd seen go into his wife's compartment last night, who had left her alive and well, and now he was sitting at dinner, quite unconscious of the fate that had befallen her. Of that there was no doubt. He did not know. A servant was leaning over Derek, handing him a note and murmuring in his ear. With a word of excuse to Lady Tamplin, he broke it open, and an expression of utter astonishment came over his face as he read. Then he looked at his hostess. "This is most extraordinary. I say, Rosalie, I'm afraid I'll have to leave you. The prefect of police wants to see me at once. I can't think what about." "Your sins have been found out," remarked Lennox. "They must have," said Derek. "Probably some idiotic nonsense, I suppose, but I shall have to push off to the prefecture. How dare the old boy rout me out from dinner? It ought to be something deadly serious to justify that." And he laughed as he pushed back his chair and rose to leave the room. Chapter 13. Van Alden Gets a Telegram. On the afternoon of the 15th February, a thick yellow fog had settled down on London. Rufus Van Alden was in his suite at the Savoy and was making the most of the atmospheric conditions by working double time. Knighton was overjoyed. He'd found it difficult of late to get his employer to concentrate on the matters in hand. When he had ventured to urge certain courses, Fenalden had put him off with a curt word. But now, Fenalden seemed to be throwing himself into work with redoubled energy, and the secretary made the most of his opportunities. Always tactful, he plied the spur so unobtrusively that Fenalden never suspected it. Yet in the middle of this absorption in business matters, one little fact lay at the back of Fenalden's mind. A chance remark of Knighton's, uttered by the secretary in all unconsciousness, had given rise to it. It now festered unseen, gradually reaching further and further forward into Fenalden's consciousness, until at last, in spite of himself, he had to yield to its insistence. He listened to what Knighton was saying with his usual air of keen attention, but in reality not one word of it penetrated his mind. He nodded automatically, however, and the secretary turned to some other paper. As he was sorting them out, his employer spoke. "Do you mind telling me that over again, Knighton?" For a moment, Knighton was at a loss. "You mean about this, sir?" He held up a closely written company report. "No, no," said Fenalden. "What you told me about seeing Ruth's maid in Paris last night. I can't make it out. You must have been mistaken."
"I can't have been mistaken, sir. I actually spoke to her."
"Well, tell me the whole thing again."
Knighton complied.
"I had fixed up the deal with Bartheimer's," he explained, "and had gone back to the Ritz to pick up my traps, preparatory to having dinner and catching the 9 o'clock train from the Gare du Nord. At the reception desk, I saw a woman whom I was quite sure was Mrs. Kettering's maid. I went up to her and asked if Mrs. Kettering was staying there."
"Yes, yes," said Fenalden, "of course, naturally. And she told you that Ruth had gone on to the Riviera and had sent her to the Ritz to await further orders there."
"Exactly, exactly that, sir."
"It's very odd," said Fenalden.
"Very odd indeed, unless the woman had been impertinent or something of that kind."
"In that case," objected Knighton, "surely Mrs. Kettering would have paid her down a sum of money and told her to go back to England. She would hardly have sent her to the Ritz."
"No," muttered the millionaire, "that's true."
He was about to say something further, but checked himself. He was fond of Knighton and liked and trusted him, but he could hardly discuss his daughter's private affairs with his secretary. He'd already felt hurt by Ruth's lack of frankness, and this chance information which had come to him did nothing to allay his misgivings. Why had Ruth got rid of her maid in Paris? What possible object or motive could she have had in so doing? He reflected for a moment or two on the curious combination of chance. How should it have occurred to Ruth, except to the wildest coincidence, that the first person that the maid should run across in Paris should be her father's secretary? Ah, but that was the way things happened. That was the way things got found out. He winced at the last phrase. It had arisen with complete naturalness to his mind. Was there then something to be found out? He hated to put this question to himself. He had no doubt of the answer. The answer was, he was sure of it, Armand de la Roche. It was bitter to Fenalden that a daughter of his should be gulled by such a man, yet he was forced to admit that she was in good company, that other well-bred and intelligent women had succumbed just as easily to the Count's fascination. Men saw through him, women did not. He sought now for a phrase that would allay any suspicion that his secretary might have felt. "Ruth is always changing her mind about things at a moment's notice," he remarked, and then he added in a would-be careless tone, "The maid didn't give any reason for this change of plan." Knighton was careful to make his voice as natural as possible as he replied, "She said, sir, that Mrs. Kettering had met a friend unexpectedly."
"Is that so?" The secretary's practiced ears caught the note of strain underlying the seemingly casual tone.
"Oh, I see. Man or woman?"
"I think she said a man, sir."
Fenalden nodded. His worst fears were being realized. He rose from his chair, and began pacing up and down the room, a habit of his when agitated. Unable to contain his feelings any longer, he burst forth. "There's one thing no man can do, and that is to get a woman to listen to reason. Somehow or other, they don't seem to have any kind of sense. Talk of women's instinct. Why, it's well known all the world over that a woman is the surest mark for any rascally swindler. Not one in ten of them knows a scoundrel when she meets one. They can be preyed on by any good-looking fellow with a soft side to his tongue. If I had my way..." He was interrupted. A page boy entered with a telegram. Fenalden tore it open, and his face went suddenly chalky white. He caught hold of the back of a chair to steady himself and waved the page boy from the room. "What's the matter, sir?" Knighton had risen in concern. "Ruth," said Fenalden hoarsely. "Mrs. Kettering?" "Killed." "An accident to the train?" Fenalden shook his head. "No. From this, it seems she's been robbed as well. They don't use the word, Knighton, but my poor girl has been murdered."
"Oh, my God, sir!"
Fenalden tapped the telegram with his forefinger. "This is from the police at Nice. I must go out there by the first train." Knighton was efficient as ever. He glanced at the clock. 5 o'clock from Victoria, sir." "That's right. You'll come with me, Knighton. Tell my man Archer and pack your own things. See to everything here. I want to go around to Curzon Street." The telephone rang sharply, and the secretary lifted the receiver. "Yes, who is it?" Then to Fenalden. "Mr. Goby, sir." "Goby? I can't see him now. No, wait. We have plenty of time. Tell them to send him up." Fenalden was a strong man. Already he'd recovered that iron calm of his. Few people would have noticed anything amiss in his greeting to Mr. Goby. "I'm pressed for time, Goby. Got anything important to tell me?" Mr. Goby coughed. "The movements of Mr. Kettering, sir. You wish them reported to you?" "Yes. Well?" "Mr. Kettering, sir, left London for the Riviera yesterday morning."
"What?"
Something in his voice must have startled Mr. Goby. That worthy gentleman departed from his usual practice of never looking at the person to whom he was talking, and stole a fleeting glance at the millionaire. "What train did he go on?" demanded Fenalden. "The blue train, sir." Mr. Goby coughed again and spoke to the clock on the mantelpiece. "Mademoiselle Morel, the dancer from the Parthenon, went by the same train."